Now entering Nerdist.com.
Big Pop Fun.
Welcome to Big Pop Fun, the podcast with your host, Tom Wilson, and guests from every corner of places that, you know, Tom has been and who he asked to be on his show. Here's Tom.
Well, hello, everybody. Thanks, and welcome to the Big Pop Fun podcast. I'm Tom Wilson, taking you on a magical sleigh ride of entertainment and wonder. As always, it's brought to you by BigPopFun.com. That's my website where I show my art. Hey, support the arts, everybody. Buy art. Support your local artist, huh? They certainly need it. And also brought to you by Boopsy.com. It's a world-class multi-platform mobile solution that is fast, flexible, and disruptively affordable. Find out more about Boopsy, oddly enough, at Boopsy.com, BOOPSIE.com. As I said, I'm Tom, and welcome. Thanks for joining me on Big Pop Fun, and consider subscribing because we're doing some fun stuff here, including this episode with Steve Odekirk. Steve Odekirk is a writer and producer of a staggeringly long list of movies and television and animation projects that could choke a horse and a half. The second horse, in fact, might just barely survive. Almost two horses. Like, say, okay, the first one choked, dead, choked that. And then the second one, if it was very large, okay, probably not, you know, it wouldn't choke it to death, but it would be coughing and needed the horse Heimlich maneuver. Or say a horse, like one horse and a pony at least, both totally choked. Two very large horses. Well, listen, I'll read you some of the stuff and you decide for yourself. He was a writer and producer on In Living Color. He produced and wrote Ace Ventura, the first one, and he did all that stuff and directed Ace Ventura 2. The list is long. The Nutty Professor movies with Eddie Murphy. Patch Adams, he wrote and produced that with Robin Williams. Bruce Almighty. Evan Almighty with Steve Carell. Cowboys and Aliens, the recent one. He wrote he's a story editor, we talk about it. So check that out. It's interesting. As well, animation projects. He's the man behind Jimmy Neutron Boy Genius and The Barnyard over at Nickelodeon and Thumb Wars, Thumbtanic. And he starred himself and put together and wrote and everything the Kung Fu movie Kung Pao Enter the Fist, which a lot of people love. Some people didn't get it, but I don't know. I thought it was real funny. But hey, let's face it. That almost choked two horses. So Steve was Steve had very little to do with sex. But Steve was a successful stand-up comedian for many years at the Comedy Store. And that's where we met. Steve was doing a lot of stand-up along with me. And we became very good friends. And we wrote some things together early on. Didn't really go anywhere. We wrote a script, among others, called "Through the Eyes of a Goat." I wonder why it didn't get produced. It was an entire movie from a goat's perspective. Like, the camera didn't change or anything. No close-ups. No nothing. The whole thing would be just through the eyes of this goat. So, and we believed in that. Baby, we built these fake goat legs out of wood and, I don't know, tape and fake fur and put hooves on them in order that so we could test the camera to see if the goat stood up on his back legs and the front legs flipped. Would it actually come into the vision of the goat? So we're out in a park somewhere with a camera shooting these scenes of a goat running through the forest with its legs flying this way and that. I know, it's a mystery it didn't go, but it was interesting and fun, and we worked on a bunch of stuff. But on though before, see, he went off to choke horses with his resume, and the horses actually ate those early scripts. And well, when horses eat stuff, you can just imagine where they ended up. So Steve's a great buddy. It was great to talk to him. Can I give one little asterisk about the interview? Yes, folks. I freely admit I'm not great at this, at the technological aspects of the recording. I work a lot as a voiceover artist, and you go to a recording studio, there are technicians who really, they're in charge of how closely I should stand to the microphone, how many pop filters. And for me, it's about 7 pop filters because, I don't know, I'm big and I speak rather loudly, and maybe it's the asthma. I'm pushing out a lot of air, so I've got a lot of plosives, a lot of P's and B's, and they pop in the microphone, and I get a little too close like that, and I'm not – a part of being a voiceover artist is to work the microphone like a violin, and I basically work a microphone like a refrigerator. I just open it, you know, look what's in there, put some stuff in, slam the door, and hope it was decent. So I know that the recording of my voice is sometimes less than spectacular, but I think it was a really fun interview, a really good conversation that we had out at his house. It's only part one. We kept going because he was there at his house at the Casa de Oudekerk down in Southern California in Orange County. So we had good fun, and I hope you enjoy my conversation with my buddy Steve Oudekerk.
It's Big Pop Fun.
Steve Oudekerk. My kids call it Oudekerk Oasis.
Really?
Because it's an oasis in Orange County, San Juan.
It's because of the dolphin.
Because of the dolphin tricks and swimming them with the dolphin. Yeah. And because you've got quite a wonderful and beautiful house down here. And thanks for having me down here.
Thank you.
Listen, I
speaking of dolphin,
yeah.
I have heard, this is recent too, and I'm not saying this is a joke. I have no jokes based on this. But evidently, have you heard of this whole dolphin rape thing? I hate to open with this, but dolphin came up, and evidently it's a real thing. Like they rape people, and
it's literally
it's a dolphin danger. You can look it up online. It's like this, and it's come up recently because I've heard it like 4 to 5 times in the last 3 months. So it must have had some either resurgence or new information that it's just a known dolphin thing. Like they're fairly dangerous. Like everyone thinks that they're all cuddly and this and that because they'll like smudge up to humans. But evidently when they're in some version of heat, they will go after things. It's like a dog would hump a leg or something, but it actually turns into authentic dolphin rape. I know this is not a great way to like lead in, but it wasn't my intention.
I think you're talking about like third season of Flipper starts.
Well, you know what? You know what's interesting is that actually didn't make the show on Flipper.
They didn't have the rape scene.
I think there was a synopsis for an episode, and then they said, no, this isn't right.
They call him Flipper.
Yeah.
It didn't even...
Run! Swim faster!
The new verse just didn't really... It didn't test well.
No. I wish I had a computer next to me, because I would feel more comfortable. At one point, I may go grab one, because I hate throwing that out there if it isn't true, but I would feel better Googling this while we're talking. I'll grab an iPad or something at one point, and
in order to Google whatever we're talking
revisit.
About, we'll revisit dolphin rape.
Yeah.
So I was I made a huge mistake because I was going to bring down the Cowboys and Aliens Collector Cup that I got at 7-Eleven.
Wow.
For you to sign.
Oh dear. Sharpie. You don't want me to sign that.
No, I did want you to sign it because it cost me 30 cents extra, and I didn't even know. It looked kind of cool, and it had the cow in the darkness thing.
Yeah.
So I just had my
But it did cost
soda.
30 cents extra. That's
what I thought they were
silly.
Free.
Like, where'd that money go?
I thought they came with, like, 89 cents for the big one, and that's what it said.
But clearly.
And then I filled that, and then a guy says, you know, like $1.39, and I was like, it's a...
That's supposed to be free marketing.
It's Cowboys and Aliens. No, you
like
pay extra for the Cowboys and Aliens.
That's
because how many years ago did I read that script that you wrote? That was great. How many years ago was that?
I should lead by saying that clearly the script I wrote is not the movie.
No, that's what I mean.
We could talk about that if you want. The 1998. Okay, so 1998 is when I set up.
You wrote a thing.
I set up Cowboys and Aliens. Yeah. It was a one-line concept from a comic book company. It was one drawing and a title, and then I came up with the story, pitched it around. There was a little bit of a bidding war going on there, and then the final two was really it was Disney, Joe Roth at Disney, and Spielberg. Who everybody really, as soon as Spielberg was interested, and I don't know if DreamWorks existed then, it might have been Amblin, but so they closed that up, and that's when I then wrote the first version of the film, which was very, very different than what just came out.
So my question, I guess, let's start with the present or sort of present-y situation, because the movie was just out.
Yeah.
And we can go way backwards, but I just wonder that a movie like that comes out. It's a huge movie with big producers and big stars and Harrison Ford.
Huge list of producers. It was literally like Spielberg, Grazer, Ron Howard.
And a million screenwriters. And seven guys on it? And you've got something. So my question is, the movie comes out.
Yes.
And it's almost in every review of the movie that they have to do that, and it had seven screenwriters and 80 producers or whatever. We'll see what this is. But how...
Which is, I think, generally, I think I'd call that a good rule of thumb. If there's been too many people involved in something, could it be great? Sure. But is the likelihood that it's been somehow compromised or at least overthought, too many chefs, over homogenized through too many different people's opinions, I would say as a general rule, yes.
So how
whether I'm involved in something like that or not. This one was an anomaly for me because that's the first film where I've ever been on the front end. I'm usually on the back end, even if it's like a rewrite situation or a page one rewrite or whatever it is. I'm usually on the back end.
Film. After they've been through five guys and they come
to
you saying, save us.
I'm the producing team that's finally ultimately doing the thing, writing the thing, writing the final version. So this was sort of my first foray in being involved in the front end and then not involved at all. I think that general rule applies.
And everyone... But what is the first impulse, do you think, when they read your script, which I read back in, long ago, and it was really strong and really fun, and you think, boy, this is going to be good. And the first person who goes, maybe Ted should look at this.
Well, that's exactly what happened. I have the opposite of any kind of sour grapes feelings because I left the project. It's not like I got fired or anybody turned away from me. In classic form of me, I didn't like the notes, so I politely left. Walter Park thought at the time he thought I was bluffing because I was in a room saying, "Hey, I don't think I'm the guy to execute that note." And I'll tell you what that is too. But it's and he kind of looked at me like, "Okay, Steve. Yeah, all right. Like I'm doing some kind of negotiating in the office, And I'm like, "No. I go, honest to God, I really don't think I'm the guy. I don't know how to do that. So I'm probably just going to leave because I don't want to burden you guys with some big argument of what I think it should be." Okay. Yeah, all right, Steve. Yeah, all right. So, literally that same day, Rob Carlson, my agent, called and said, Steve's off the project. And he went ballistic. Like, what are you talking about? He can't leave. And then I end up talking to him again. I said, I told you. We were sitting there. He goes, "I didn't think you were serious." So here's how that went down. Basically, I wrote the first draft of the way I not only saw the movie, but the same way I described it to everyone. It was the same thing I set up, everybody seemed to be real happy, It's like, "Hey, this is great, this is this and that." But you know what we really want is Unforgiven.
Wow.
Yeah. And that was the line. And that was the one that really stood out to me because there were other things we talked about and other things within the draft. But it really came down to we want Unforgiven. And Steven wants Unforgiven, and we think that's the tone. And we want to merge these two genres and respectfully merge them, honoring the great Westerns and the great, sci-fi films. And so then I'm saying, so you basically got to go straight drama. And they're going, "Yeah." And then I'm, literally, I would even be apt to say, humbly saying, "I'm not that guy." I go, "I'm not that guy." I go, because it's, and I have a simple paradigm with me in movies. If I don't want to go see it, I'm not the guy that should write it. So I basically said that. I go that might be the greatest movie since the beginning of time, but it doesn't excite me. So if I'm not excited by it, then I can't write it, so I'm not the guy. So that's really how that went down. And as you know, because you read the script, mine was this, quote unquote, suited the title a little bit more, because it was this big, fun, totally, you know, original visuals. You wouldn't go to it and say, I've seen that before. It was its own thing, and it was the folk. It wasn't a comedy. I mean, I had a dramatic through line, but it was sort of a big action adventure with a lot of fun stuff in it. So now you cut to today, the movie that actually came out somehow. I mean, in a way, it's kind of impressive. Somehow, through all those writers, through all those incarnations, through the entire final team, even when you hear them talk about the movie, the primary thing they say is, "We finally nailed the tone." It's like a serious merging of these two genres, and it's exactly the movie that I didn't get excited about. I think they did a very good job. I think it's very professionally made. I think some of the acting is really good. I was actually surprised that Daniel Craig was excellent in a Western, you know. And that's why I think it maybe fell apart a little bit as soon as Aliens showed up, because suddenly his role, his character wasn't as credible anymore. You know, it's like... I think they did a really good job, but whereas they think they nailed the tone, to me it was like, wow, they just missed the tone. They missed the tone, man. Cowboys and Aliens is supposed to be a big, fun movie that you leave a theater and you tell other people,
right.
Oh my gosh, you have to see this. You won't even believe this one part. But unfortunately, the choice of the tone eliminated the concept of saying you won't even believe this one part because
you would believe
the agenda. Yes, you would believe it, and the agenda was to combine two things you've already seen before. And the special nature, I get the intention. The intention is, what will be special about this is we'll take these two things people have seen before and we'll put them together. So what will be
special, instead of something that no one's ever seen before?
Exactly correct. So that I would just say is a perception and an agenda difference in terms of what my goals would have been with the film. And then the shared story credit that I ended up getting actually makes sense, because there's enough parameters within the through line that remained the same. So from a Writers Guild standpoint, it's like, well, we can't not give this guy credit because there's so much of the core story that remains. But it really is like, well, you know, it's like a page one. You know, I mean, there was a complete redo of my script. It was, I can't tout any credit for that.
So at the end of it, as a screenwriter, written all these things, and a producer of so many movies, when you have that thing that happens to that script that you go, boy, that was good in 1998. That's good. Are you really good at just, you know, cutting off ties to that in your mind? Or do you have a thing that goes on for a period of time going, boy, that it would have been great to make that, or could I change that in some way to get the vision that I had and the Cowboys and Aliens, but to do a thing that would be like the thing that I had?
Well, you know, to a degree, I'm pretty resilient, because I feel like I don't want to get like into a weird headspace where I'll carry stuff. So I make myself okay with it. But I got to admit, when I was there at the premiere watching the film, it was a unique experience I had never had before. It was very surrealistic, because I was just sort of watching... Wow, this isn't the thing. this isn't it. Wow, this really isn't it. Wow, it's done. Like, it's done, and it's not the thing. You know, so I immediately afterwards, because Tony and the girls were with me, and I afterwards I go, boy, I'm so not the guy to judge this film, because I can't really watch it with totally clear eyes. All I was seeing was just a big wall of, wow, this isn't it.
Yes. So is it like those, you know, like the novelists that will have their novel made into a movie, and they have that feeling of, well, but it's not even close to my book. And the guys just say, here's a lot of money. And they go, oh, okay.
Yeah, kind of, but not so much the lot of money thing. I mean, for me, it was really more like, if you follow the path of what took place, once again, I left the project. I mean, no one rudely booted me out a door. I ran into a situation where I set something up. I wanted it to be a certain thing. To this day, I still think it would have been more successful in that path or version. But the reality is that it I saw the ship going a different direction than I wanted to go. So I said, no, I don't think I can do that. But hey, good luck, you guys. I wish it had been a huge hit for everybody, you know, but the reality is, I stepped away. So no, I think it would feel a little self-indulgent if I now said, boy, that really should have been my original vision. You know, that doesn't make sense. I mean, I ultimately left because I didn't want to battle, you know, a pre-existing notion that like Spielberg and Walter had that viably could have made a really great film. You know, I just felt like I don't want to butt heads with these guys. If I have this different of a opinion of what the movie should be, I shouldn't be the guy doing this. You know, because these guys, I have far too much respect, especially for Spielberg. You know,
I want to go way back into comedy and our relationships and everything. But since we're on the subject, I wonder, do you think about tone of a movie, or when you're thinking of something, do you just think of what would be funny and adventurous?
I think in the brainstorming phase, which I always start with, you're literally thinking of what could be really funny, what could be awesome, you know, literally what would be great. You know, sometimes it's a funny thing. Other times it's just a story point where you just go, oh my gosh, that would be phenomenal. And you have no way to get to it. You have no way out of it, but it's just a fragment that you think would be really awesome. I like starting that way for no other reason than if I don't have a lot of those, writing's a little overwhelming. You know, I like to know I have some things that I think would be great movie moments. So I spend a lot of time brainstorming before I outline. And in the case of Cowboys and Aliens, I can tell you this on any movie I've done, where at what point I had a breakthrough where I felt like I had a movie. And on Cowboys and Aliens, and it's usually not a joke, it's usually not a funny scene or something like that. On Cowboys and Aliens, my breakthrough, and again, this didn't make it into the movie, the final version of the movie, but my personal breakthrough was I had a character base of originally a primary cowboy character, which the film now has. I had a primary Indian character, which the film does not have. And from early in the film, I established that they both hated the other character's race for authentic reasons. Mm-hmm. You know, my main character saw his parents killed. So he had every reason to absolutely be to the level of racist against the concept of Indians. And the Indian guy, for every reason you would imagine, just hates the white man because he's seen the ugly things that took place when all they were doing was living and people came in wanting their land and these atrocities that took place. So to them, they're just, you know, just defending. You know, so you have these two guys that were very set in their ways and just very, very, you know, convicted in their beliefs and hate each other authentically. Then through the course of the film, as these aliens show up, you end up having this situation where in my version of the movie, the aliens ultimately came there to colonize. They weren't there in the current version of the film. They want gold. They like gold just as much as we do, for whatever reason. I don't know. It's not to really describe. But in mine, it's like they came to colonize because they needed space. So ultimately, they came to Earth for the exact same reasons that we came to America, mm-hmm. which is we want land, man. We have nothing against you. You're just kind of in the way. You know, yeah. We need some of your space. Don't be greedy. So they kind of came in the same way. And then ultimately that allowed my cowboy character to have a character arc and an epiphany. Because at a key point in the movie, he got to realize he was the bad guy. As much as he had his own baggage that was authentic and real, he got to realize, oh my gosh, we're fighting against these guys. They're doing the exact same thing to us that we just did to these other people. So that is the point where the relationship started to mend between his character and the Indian character, because he basically was now accountable for what his people did. Even though that led to something terrible in his own life, it was ultimately caused not from a force that he had thought of before. So that to me gave me a movie. And I felt really, really awesome about having that construct because, again, I was planning on packing fun and incredibly unique visuals into this thing. And I wanted to know that I had authentically had a heart at the end of this film that was real and I could have a true character resolution. So what happens in the rewrite process that I've not been a part of, again, from this angle, is you'll see this situation where, like, Harrison Ford's character is sort of got the elements of my main character within him, but none of it's front loaded. It's all sort of back loaded, and the Indian characters come in very late in the film. So those elements, you know, my main character is now a split. He's a hybrid. Part of my main character is in Daniel Craig's character. Part of my main character is in Harrison Ford's character. And they decided to not go with an American Indian character, primarily because if the rule stayed the same from when we were talking in 98, they didn't want to get into that. Like, they didn't want to suss up the whole, you know, racism and between, you know, people hating each other for those kinds of reasons. So they didn't want to go there. Mm-hmm. So you know, you just sort of see things sort of get split around and...
Well, I'm sorry I didn't get to see that 98 version because I really liked it. I thought it was really
good. It was crazy, man. Well, you know, when I was watching the movie and I coupled those images in my head, like the horse walking into town, you know, and on two legs and all that stuff. It's like, yeah, it's kind of great trailer stuff too, you know.
So what aspects of this guy you are now, the guy who really, really breaks down stories and characters so, I think, quickly and with such great facility, what part of that was in you, you know, in high school or when you were a kid? Because, I mean, you grew up in Huntington Beach, right? A normal, quote-unquote, guy.
I don't have any...
Dad and mom there?
I don't have any of the comedy, broken home, terrible life, you know.
Yeah, you don't. You just grew up in a pretty...
To be angry against.
Yeah,
you know?
not with a
I'm
lot
adopted.
Of money.
I'm adopted. What? Maybe I hate my birth parents.
Is that it?
And maybe there could be a fetal level of hate that doesn't have a word yet. I guess it would be
fetatred.
Yeah. It's actually where the word fatal came from. It was fetal hate.
Okay.
Turned into a word that was fatal at one point. I don't really have any kind of...
Your mom and dad, friendly, wonderful people, Huntington Beach, California, a pretty idyllic.
Pretty normal, you know. But when you have parents, you know, contrary to what people think, you know, when you are adopted, there really isn't a thing where you're walking around going, oh my gosh, I wonder who they are. You know, you have these parents that by and large, I'm sure there's some exceptions to this, but by and large you have parents that weren't able to have kids. So you kind of have these uber parents, at least in one of them, because they're so thankful. They're so thankful to have a child that you get overly loved. You know, and my mom was exacerbated by the fact that she was full-blooded Italian. So there was this big emotional attachment to me and my sister and this massive amount of love, which I've always really described as the only way I could describe the level of my mom's love, which was to the point of not correct. It would be like if she watched me murder someone in cold blood with a knife, she would just snatch the knife from me, be washing it off in the sink going, Stephen, you just go to your room. If somebody knocks at the door, you do not say one word. You just be quiet. I will deal with you later. You know, and then she goes and buries the knife and all that. You know, that was sort of like my mom. It was me and my sister first. We could do no wrong and just quite a wonderful, wonderful woman.
But what happened? Was it in high school? You just started goofing off?
Maybe the part of it's the Catholic school thing. You know, when I did stand-up, I decided to never do any material on Catholic school because I thought George Carlin so wonderfully covered it.
And nor did I,
in one of his albums, you know. It was just, he nailed it. I mean, if you have any comedy inclinations at all, I think it's why you see a lot of Jewish comics. I think it's why you see Catholic comics is any version of authority. And you have an inclination to fight authority, and then you put somebody in that kind of environment where it's all about rules, it's great for somebody, a developing comedy mind, because you spend your whole life being sarcastic, fighting the system, battling with words and logic. So I don't know. I don't know where you get the troublemaker or don't go with the flow or counter-programming gene, but I always had it. I grew up in Huntington Beach. Everyone I know surfed. I didn't like going to the beach. I mean, it was always, it was just my sort of thing. You know, everybody around me is listening to music. I'm listening to comedy albums. You know,
How far were you from the beach in your house? I mean, it was very close.
Oh, maximum a mile, maybe.
A mile from the beach in Huntington Beach with all surf dudes. And you just,
no,
you
I
just
don't like
never
it.
Went.
Honestly, I don't like the water meets the sand concept at all. I don't like it. I don't, I don't, understand it. I don't think that I don't think it's a good design. You know, I think you walk out of water and then there's sand stuck to you, like you're, the calf's down. And of all awful things, sand, it don't even stay on you. It slowly trickles off. And you go about your day in other areas and you're finding sand in your shoe and you're still finding sand. It's an awful plan. And then they have the sand off station, which after you leave, you walk through sand.
Right. You're still sanding.
Yeah, they never put
You have less sand, though. Less sand.
You have less sand, but you still have to somehow go through sand. They never put them at a past sand zone, you know.
Right. And then you have wet feet from the shower that are now covered in wet sand.
Yeah, you're picking up new post sand,
but
which probably fell off somebody else's leg.
You have to wait until that sand dries, and then you knock off that sand.
Well, yeah.
So then there's some sand left.
No, you're better off not stopping at the wash station because you can dry off, you can brush off dry sand better. But the reality is you're still finding sand. As long as the day goes on, you're still finding sand. And that is like, you know.
But the wash station is you get it out of your swim trunks. You get it out of your hair. You get a lot of it out.
Yeah. But I still think it wasn't like God made a mistake with the beach. I just don't think people were intended to go there. You know what I mean? I don't think it was meant for, you know, groups and things like that, you know.
Attention bathers and surfers. It's just wrong.
Yeah, it's a visual. It's a nice visual. He built this wonderful visual that is clearly like, well, don't come walk over here. This stuff will stick to you.
He put the dolphin rapists in there for a reason. So
exactly
out of the water.
Exactly correct. You know, and seeing it would be like going to, have you guys been to Sticky Land? You know? Sticky Land's great. What do you mean? What's Sticky Land? Oh, there's all this stuff to jump on, and you can roll under it, and it's got tubes to crawl through. Yeah, but what's with the sticky thing? Oh, it's all sticky. All of it's sticky.
At the end, you just
what
have
do you mean?
Stuff.
At the end of the day, you're sticky? Yeah, you're sticky all over the place. And then they have a station where you can wipe most of it off. What do you mean, but I get in my car, and I'm still a little sticky? Yeah. Okay, well, you know where I'm not going this month? Sticky Land.
Right.
I'm not going to Sticky Land.
So we've established you hate the beach.
I actually don't hate it.
You don't hate it. You like looking at it.
I think it's beautiful.
From a window.
Exactly. And then when you go to certain settings, I actually really do like the beach. Like if I go to Hawaii, if I'm away from my home or anything I own, then I like the beach.
So unknown beaches are okay?
Because.
Foreign sand?
Because who cares if I get it sandy? There's no, I leave. You're at a hotel. I go back to the hotel room.
And sand all over the place.
It's kind of a drag, though, because you still have sand there the next day that you don't want.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So I'm not, you know, yeah, I'm tepid. I'm tepid with the
You're
beach.
Tepid about Hawaii beaches. You hate Huntington Beach, California.
Yeah, and the water's cold, you know.
The water is cold.
Yeah.
So what? So what'd you do in high school? You played tennis. You were an athlete. But what did you do in order to...
I went from basketball to tennis. I was mostly basketball, and then I got that thing where I grew all at once and my knees were jacked up, so I couldn't do anything for a couple of years, athletic.
Were you one of those guys watching Carlin on The Tonight Show and doing that, or Steve Martin at that time or whatever,
yeah.
And thinking,
I mean, relentlessly,
man, I'm doing that.
I decided to do what I'm doing now when I was like six.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I was like... But as early as I could even
literally think, stand up, or I just want to be in front of people.
I didn't know what any of it meant. I was six. Back off. No, I didn't write out a plan. No, but I was literally like this little kid, and I don't know what it meant. But when I watched comedy on TV and movies, I liked it so much that I just knew I wanted to do it. And then that made me even more of a challenge in school because I was always convinced. Well, this isn't my path. Now, luckily, I got lucky. This is what's great about having awesome parents is I needed that education. You know, I got this crazy, it was like St. Bonaventure to modern day.
Right.
So it's not an easy high school. So I got it forced into me. You couldn't ditch. You couldn't, you know, there was no way to play the system.
Right.
So, and I had to pull B's or I had no life, you know, with my parents. So I got lucky on all those counts. I didn't have those parents that were like, well, you know, he tries hard, but, he's not that good and he gets D's. You know, no, it was like, you don't get B's, you don't have a life. You're in your room. So I ultimately got an education sort of against my will, which has been greatly beneficial, you know, in my career, you know. So... But no, I always knew I wasn't, you know, my parents didn't really have money, so there was really no college talk of any kind. I knew I was going to Golden West Junior College. ultimately, that was so much easier than modern day that I played tennis all day. And then I started doing, I dove into stand-up, I think, when I was 19. And then I just quit school and my job the next day.
The next day?
There was a talent show at Golden West Junior College. So that morning, I wrote up 5 minutes of stand-up, went to the talent show, and I'd been at Golden West about a year and a half. And the next morning, I went and quit school. I signed myself out. And I called Marie Callender's, where I was a waiter, 2 days a week. Not even like it was eating up my schedule, you know, 2 days a week.
But the 2 day a week, Marie Callender's.
It felt cumbersome.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
So I quit literally the next morning. And then, you know, my dad, who, like, of course, went through the Depression
sure.
and scraped to get us this private education, you know, had to listen to me confidently saying, no, this is what I'm going to do now. Well, I'm still living at home.
You were living at home, and you were like, "Dad, Mom, I'm going to be a stand-up comedian."
Yeah,
and
the rest of that year, I was laying in a chaise lounge in the sun in the backyard with a notepad writing jokes. Literally.
Were you performing anywhere?
It was just a constant fight. It was a constant fight with my dad.
He was really upset about it?
Oh, my gosh, yeah. It was unimaginable. He thought I was going to be a bum. I mean, I get it. You know, being a parent now, I totally get it. You know, I had no agenda to go to get a job. I had no agenda to get, even when I started doing stand-up, I had no agenda to get a paying job because I thought if I get paid, then I have to deliver and I can't try out new material.
Right.
So I was actually fairly obsessed with not working the first couple years of doing stand-up. I liked open mic nights.
Just to try stuff.
Well, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Build up material.
Yeah. And you were building prop things at that time and everything?
It was a mix, you know. I never understood that the rule book of stand up, you know.
You and I could go for hours today, on that thing.
Yeah, I mean, I don't get it to this day, but when I was a kid, I mean, I way didn't understand the rule book of stand up. It was like, to me, I've lived my life not respecting rules to that point.
Right.
So to me, when I started doing stand-up, and, you know, clearly, if you look at what the stuff I like to do now, it's like TV shows or movies or CG animation, clearly there's a lot of visuals popping around in my head.
Sure.
So when I did stand-up, it's not like there was a less version of visuals popping around in my head or audio-visual presentations or, you know, for back in that time, come on, when we were doing this stuff, I was tracking, like, the first camcorder coming out. You know, it's like, wow, could I actually shoot video and show it in a club?
Right.
You know, I mean, that's where my head was.
Yeah.
So I had some monology, but I didn't look at stand-up as a thing where I needed to template off of anyone else.
Right. And let me describe, because a lot of people who listen to this may not be stand-up comedians. They might not know what we're talking about.
Oh, okay.
But Steve used props in his act. He had cut out an old guitar and put kind of a boom box in the guitar so he would play a tape of him playing the guitar and turn around. It all got huge laughs.
Audio tapes playing. I mean, yeah. I held up a severed head and there was a, you know, audio tape of the severed head's voice who was a psychic. I mean, it was
and taped
ridiculously
pieces
inane.
And all kinds of, you had a jacket with several, four or five sleeves that was a trick jacket that you would do a dance at a disco.
Multiple arms. And
people would scream. I mean, it would just get screams.
And there was no logical path to it. There was no, who is this guy? Boy, his voice. You know, is this?
Yeah.
I mean, it was like to anyone, like, I remember I worked in Denver at one point. I was headlining a club in Denver and had a great week. And then the guy that wrote the review was writing the review, and he said, you know, the problem is, after I was done seeing him, I just didn't know who he was. And I remember my immediate thought was, that's fantastic. That's what that's sort of what I'm going for. It wasn't really me for somebody to walk away and know what my perspective of life was. I mean, I see myself as intermission. You know, it's like, I'm not teaching what I'm doing. When I think I'm at my best, I'm someone's relief from their week.
Sure. Come to the carnival.
Exactly. They had to deal with their boss. They had to deal with drive-by shootings on TV.
You have dealt with in your life, and I in mine, that this upsets the observationalist standing in front of the brick wall.
Yeah, well, I'll split that out. So the reality is in stand-up, and this lives to today, as far as I can see, is there's a...
I think to a greater degree today than ever.
I think so. There's a rule of how you do stand-up comedy. It's like, it's got to be monology, so you can only use words. And then preferably you're noticing things that other people notice day in and day out.
Spinach is weird, huh?
Yeah, but the way you notice, and I mean authentically, because there's some people that just really crack me up this paradigm. I mean, Louis C.K., I mean, he's such a funny guy.
Absolutely.
I love watching his stuff, but it's working within the allowed paradigm of you notice a thing, you look at it a different way, and it makes everybody laugh because they've seen it before, they've noticed it before, but they never really looked at it in that way. But overall, they agree with you. Hence the statement, it's so true,
right.
You know, that people will do when they're laughing. What's interesting is that stand-up, which are supposed to be the most rebellious of the rebellious. I mean, rockers are rebellious. Stand-up comics are meant to be the scathing, satirical versions of rebellion, where we are
okay. Way more rebellious than rockers.
And we're okay to joke about anything, and nothing's sacred and all of this. Somehow, within the segment of stand-up comedy, there is a rule of a way that you have to do it. So I don't know how other people wrap their heads around that. Maybe it's a security system. Maybe it's a country club sort of element. I don't know. But all I can speak for is myself. You take a guy like me, where I spent my whole life not following rules, and then I show up at a comedy club and somebody tells me how I'm supposed to do comedy, guess what? I'm not doing it.
Right.
I'm not doing it. By nature, I'm not doing it. You know, I've even made mistakes in life where I go against, you know, if the big, huge guy says, don't touch the ball, I'll kick you in the face. You know, I'm touching the ball going, what? Which part of my face are you kicking, huh? You know, so I still find it kind of funny that in a marauder's world, there's actually a rule book as to how you're supposed to do your comedy. I still don't agree with it. I think comedy would be way more interesting if more people just created their own thing. Like, they literally just sat alone at home and said, if I'd never seen a comic and I wanted to do something funny, what would I go do? I think the terrain of stand-up comedy would be much more interesting. And I think pre the boom, which is really pre you and me starting out, I think it was more like that. I mean, I think there was a little more diversity of Bill Cosby being a guy who just sat in a chair and told
stories.
Now,
what year did you start doing it?
80.
I started in 79.
Okay.
But you could still see the guys who were doing very unusual things.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember at the Comedy Store, Ed Begley Jr. and Michael Richards played kind of silent movie comedy music and just sawed a table apart.
Yeah.
They had like a dining room table on stage,
yeah,
and they just brought out saws, and that was their act.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, it was sort of for the back of the room, and comics really liked it, and the audience is going, I don't know what it is, but they were just doing a thing.
Yeah, or Andy Kaufman.
You know, well, of course,
Andy was before us, and that was before comedy was really had a real rule book to it, and you know, he just did his own thing, and it was weird, and mm-hmm. it was different, and some people didn't like it, but it to me, that resonates really well with the concept of comedy is if you like it, great. If you don't get it, I'm not walking you through this party. You know,
it's
like, right. I like doing stuff like that. I mean, that's what Kung Pao was. You know, Kung Pao's a movie that either has these massive fans, sort of like when I was a kid, like in Python, is like the kids that come up to me about Kung Pao and they know every line. Or you'll have humans that don't even see a joke. I mean, literally, like, not only is it not funny, it's not funny to the millionth degree because they can't see the joke. And people that can't see a joke tend to get pissed off. So they'll really say, well, it's stupid. I don't like that, you know, because they don't get it.
But as you said, there are brilliant comedians in every respect, in every different style of comedy. But the interesting thing is the impulse for a lot of guys to start going, yeah, I'm good, and this section is good, but this slice of the pie, I don't think so.
Yeah.
And it's a bunch of guys who are doing great.
Yeah.
I mean, when you and I were starting out and Denny Johnston was doing the Comedy Store on Saturday night, it's almost impossible to describe what was happening in that room.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, people were falling up, literally falling off their chairs.
It was all new. I mean, it's a lot of the things that now are, you know, cliches and redos at one point were authentic.
They got written.
I mean, if you track back way past us, you know, and you go way earlier, you can see the path of the business of stand-up comedy. I think the business of stand-up comedy started with Lenny Bruce, because before Lenny Bruce, everybody was doing bits. It was more like sketches, you know. And then Lenny Bruce shows up, and granted, not the tightest material in the world, but he actually went on stage and just started talking to people. But he didn't really coin "Have you ever noticed" that at all, which was Carlin. You know, and George was so far back that when he started, he was still doing sketches.
Right.
So if you see
takeoffs
and put-ons.
Oh, he had fright wigs and the whole thing, and was a team with Jack Burns.
Yeah, and you see his first album, even as a solo, it's all these bits, you know, Wonderful Wino, you know, he's got all his bits and everything, and they're really funny, and he was really, really good at that. But then he, I'm figuring, influenced by Lenny Bruce, I don't know. I don't believe anyone pre-him created "Have You Ever Noticed." I think it was Carlin. You know, and then Pryor was doing his own version of Lenny Bruce
talking, an expression of my life,
which was phenomenal. You know, and then you still had Cheech and Chong, which were back in that same time, but they were doing bits,
right?
You know,
sketches.
and that was kind of cool. It was all coexisting. No one was like, "Oh, well, Cheech and Chong are doing bits, they should be doing regular monology." You know, no, it was like, it was everybody, I think, was still kind of doing their thing and feeling it out. But then if we keep tracking the business of stand-up through, from Carlin, you know, created all the Kippadottas. You know, Kip, to me, is one of the strongest monologists I've ever seen.
Leno, Robert Klein,
Leno
and David Steinberg.
At his best. Everybody knows Jay now from The Tonight Show, but Leno at his best was
a magnificent comedian.
Oh, a consummate monologist, you know, of what you do and "Have You Ever Noticed." Then you get to Seinfeld, who this new level of mastery of "Have You Ever Noticed" material, I think. I mean, I think he took the Carlin, you know, mantle and just said, okay, this is what this is going to be now. And Jerry, you know, sans bombastic personality, you know, sans selling with a huge performance skills. No, man, the guy could just sit there and sing song, you know, stuff that was so cleverly put together that it just... once again, it solidified the business even more firmly. And then beyond that point, I think, sadly, that's the business. That's the business of stand-up, is you go up and you do it this way. And then what's interesting about stand-up now, which I do like, is you take different personalities, and you put different personalities into it, and that business works quite well. It's still interesting. It's still funny. You take, you know, really pity that Mitch Hedberg died. I mean, holy smokes, man, did that guy make me laugh. And he was this version of Stephen Wright. You know, it was the same kind of Stephen Wright kind of thing where he was just his, but so his own beast. I mean, his rhythm, his patterns, it was just, I just thought brilliant to take something so simple and make it so unique, you know. And then you'll see Stephen Wright's an example. You get different guys that, you know, if you get the Sam Kennison world, you've got Sam, you've got Dice, who jumped onto Sam, you've got Lewis Black, which is like in that Sam vein. You got Bill Hicks, who, I don't know how you categorize Bill. Bill did like a Carlin curve. Bill went from very commercial, kind of very clever, funny material to more of a Kennison-esque, I'm going to speak my mind kind of stuff. But I always thought Bill was really, had a brilliantly funny mind. So, you know, you still get to see these, you know, guys that really split out their footprint with normal monology. And I think that's wonderful. But you still kind of go, okay, but isn't there comedy? why are more people not doing the exact same type of comedy? You know, it's like it's the same type, but with a different personality. Might be more interesting just to see a collection of, you know, Joel Hodgson is probably one of my personal favorite comics.
Oh, he's great.
He retired from the business essentially because he did, from what I heard,
Mystery Science Theater?
Well, no, so no, it's from stand up. I heard he stopped doing stand up because he didn't like the way the industry was, which mm-hmm. I've always really respected. I don't know if that's true, but that's what I heard. But man, was that guy unique and funny. And he dipped in and out. He would do just regular monology, but then he'd bring some weird thing. And
sure.
You know.
But if you listen to, I mean, Bill Hicks, who's a friend of yours, a friend yeah. of mine of many years, if you listen to his stand-up, there are plenty of bits in there. In between his speaking truth to power.
Oh, very much. He started with bits.
Right. Bills, there are many just yeah. straight up stand up bits.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
So, wow. We've already taken up a lot of time in episode one.
There you go.
Let me just ask you, do you think someone will come out and do something either physical or visual and it will be seen by people? Or now, and I don't mean to denigrate them. I mean, when the 19-year-old is coming and saying, I want to do stand-up comedy, are the cultural images so strong in his head now from An Evening at the Improv and all when you see the brick wall and the microphone that he's going to go, well, I have to notice stuff and I have to talk about pain?
I think there's a wonderful curve of life and a wonderful thing within the entertainment industry, which is doorways, you know. So you've got some doorways that are kind of closed. They open occasionally, and there's this massive long line of people that are at that doorway. And everybody's trying to figure out, how can I get through that doorway? How do I get, you know, who do I talk to? How do I meet a guy? How do I do this? It's so competitive. This is so hard. This is so this. And then about 20 feet over is this open, wide open doorway with cobwebs on it. And no one's in line there because no one's in line there. But it's open. It's this big, wide-open doorway, and no one thinks it leads to success because there's no one there. But yes, inevitably it will happen all the time, periodically, because you'll occasionally get a free thinker that will go check out that other doorway, and they'll do it a different way. And for them, the door's wide open, and they don't have as much competition. So it's like, you know, you'll see this occasionally now on YouTube, where there'll be a YouTube person that'll pop open that's a star, whether it's from music world. This is going to keep happening. It's going to keep happening where there'll be a celebrity that'll come here. I think we have the new guy, Burnham, the guy that does
Bo Burnham.
Yeah, so, you know, yeah. I think he started with the whole YouTube and song things. Young guy, very funny, you know, intelligent stuff.
Sure.
And it's like, you know, you're going to see that more and more because there's an expression of originality of, I just want to do this. I just want to do this. This is what I do. And now there's a forum for people to even show it where it can catch on. And in my opinion, those are all open doorways. Those are all the ones that are easy to go through. And they're more fun because you're doing exactly what you want to do. If you're doing what everybody else does and getting your own little spin on it, you're in a big old line. You might make it work. You know, it might work out famously, but you're in a big old line. You're in a big mob. You know, and if you do your own thing, you're not in a mob at all. You have to, it's a little more daring. You have to be willing to have everybody say, you know, the stuff that you really like, it's not entertaining at all. You know, I mean, you have to be willing for that, but that goes with the territory. It always feels more vulnerable when you're not doing something like everyone else. So I think the monology path, when it's not organic, if it's organic to someone, it's exactly what they should do. When it's not organic to someone, but they think it's about the way you should do it, then I think, honestly, they're playing it safe. They don't want to be laughed at. They don't want to be told they're really bad. They don't want to step out of the box. Because if you step out of the box, you are going to get attacked. Period. Until you're successful, you're going to have tons of people saying, you're awful, you don't know how to do it right, you're doing it wrong. And I think it goes with the territory.
Steve Oedekerk, thanks.
You're welcome.
Thanks so much to my good friend Steve Oedekerk for joining me on this episode of the podcast. Hey, tune in again, because I talked to Steve for quite a long time down there at Oedekerk Oasis, his fabulous compound. It's beautiful and large, and it's chained off with mafia guys around it. Yeah, Kay still has the kids in the car trying to go to the market, but Tom Hagen won't let her leave. Thanks to Emily Wilson for producing. Thanks to everybody at Nerdist Industries, Chris Hardwick and Katie over there. Thanks to McPherson Guitars and Dean Markley Strings. But most of all, thanks to you. Hey, thanks for joining me. And consider subscribing or consider coming out to a show, because I traipse all across this great land of ours. So come on out. We'll see you next time. Thanks.
Nerdist.com.